I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Peyton Gendron has been charged with first-degree murder for the shooting deaths of 10 black people shopping at the Ace supermarket in Buffalo, New York on Saturday. Three more people were wounded. It's the deadliest mass shooting this year, which is not yet half over. Gendron posted his deadly plans online to kill black people, calling himself a white supremacist and anti-Semite. He made references to something called the Great Replacement Theory, a conspiracy that elites are bringing non-white people to America to wipe out the white race for political purposes. Now, this used to be a fringe idea, which has been gaining in popularity, going more mainstream. President Biden went to Buffalo with the First Lady this week to console mourners and to speak about the threat of what he called domestic terrorism.
White supremacy is a poison. It's a poison running through our, it really is, running through our body politic. And it's been allowed to fester and grow right in front of our eyes. No more. I mean, no more. We need to say as clearly and forcefully as we can that the ideology of white supremacy has no place in America. None.
We have a lot to talk about. Let me introduce our two guests. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio, Bishop Dwayne Royster. He is executive director of POWER. That's the largest faith-based social justice organization in Pennsylvania. Bishop Royster, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Appreciate being here.
Absolutely. And Kurt Braddock is with us as well. He's assistant professor in the School of Communication and faculty fellow at the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab. His research focuses on the persuasive strategies used by violent extremist groups to recruit and radicalize. Kurt Braddock, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much, Marty.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, we want to make sure that you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. I want to begin with you, Bishop Royster. Mm-hmm. Just thinking about the family, the friends, the community of people up in Buffalo, New York, who are dealing with the aftermath of this shooting, the grief that they must be feeling, the anger, the frustration that they must be feeling. How can we help them?
Yeah, thank you, Marty, for having me and for starting with that question. First and foremost, I mean, we send all of our condolences out to all the families there and also to the whole city of Buffalo. Over the last several years, prior to coming back to Philadelphia to lead POWER, I was actually the Northeast Regional Director for Faith in Action, and Buffalo was one of the cities that we have a sister organization to POWER there called Voice Buffalo. The Reverend Denise Walden Glenn is the executive director there. I've spent probably 3 years, I've done over 20 visits to Buffalo. And so I've gotten to know that community very well. It's not a huge city compared to Philadelphia, and it's a very tight-knit community. So this has been absolutely devastating up there on the ground. I've talked to my colleagues up there. They're just, the community in many ways is almost inconsolable at this moment to be able to think about that. It's a working-class community, very much like Philadelphia in that regard. People who were striving to just do the best they could. And when we took a look at those that were killed, these were older folk, many of them people of faith, who were, you know, in the supermarket, some helping to take care of family, some buying a birthday cake, some helping out another family member.
Just living their lives.
Absolutely.
Right?
And not thinking that the day I'm going to go to the supermarket, which in the African-American community is a sacred space, in much the same way that our congregations are, because food is a love language in our community. And so to violate that space is absolutely devastating, because it's the one space we feel we should be safe.
Well, let me turn to you, Kurt Braddock, and just picking up on that, because I'm thinking of other mass shootings, not just supermarkets, but churches, synagogues, mosques, schools, bars. I mean, places where people feel that they can go and be with other people or enjoy themselves or feel connected to their community. And these places have become shooting ranges in certain instances.
And that's kind of the whole point for these attackers, is that they want people to feel unsafe when they go in these places. I think that this attacker in Buffalo, he actually said that he chose the supermarket because he wanted people to feel unsafe wherever they were. And that's the definition of terrorism. I know that that word is chosen for specific attacks, and I think that this attack definitely qualifies, because he chose the supermarket to instill fear in people beyond those he actually hurt and killed. The Reverend talked about these sacred places that are chosen as targets, and that's often the case among violent extremists, that they choose these places because they are symbolic.
Well, and picking up on that and going back to you, Dr. Bishop Royster, which is then, does it make all black people in America feel unsafe? Because there could be some, you know, some white terrorist that wants to do evil.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're deeply struggling with this. Just a little while from now, after we leave here today, I'm headed over to Mother Bethel AME Church. And I mean, it goes back to remind us about what happened at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, or what happened at the mosque in Christchurch in New Zealand, or Tree of Life in Pittsburgh, right? Mm-hmm. You don't feel safe anywhere. I mean, let's be honest. He made an incursion into an African-American community. He had come there the day before, scouted around. As a matter of fact, people were trying to figure out why he was there, because he looked very out of place in that space. And so we kind of don't feel safe. I mean, I know when I'm in my congregation, I'm kind of watching who's coming through the door. Mm-hmm. You know, I've actually heard some of my African-American siblings saying to me, you know, maybe it's time we started arming ourselves, and just because we don't know.
In church
and in anywhere, you know, because we just don't know when something's going to happen. If folk will come in our community, violate, you know, our community and just do whatever they think that they want to do. I mean, like you said, it's the absolute act of terrorism to make people be afraid to walk outside the door of their homes.
How do we talk about this, though? Let me start with you, Kurt. And in terms of the words that we use, you know, it's pretty clear everything that I read about this young man is that he wanted the kind of attention that he is clearly getting. It almost looked like he wanted to get caught, that he left, you know, so many breadcrumbs for people to figure out who he is.
Right.
So how do we talk about this without giving him the attention that he does not deserve? And of course, we're talking about 10 people who have died, and I haven't even said their names yet. But let me start with you, Kurt.
Right. Well, I think the first step is we need to be better about recognizing when something is a terrorist act and calling it that. Within the academic and the professional community that deals with these issues, there's often debates surrounding what's terrorism, what's not. And if you ask 100 different experts, you get 100 different responses. Something I'm heartened by in seeing with the current administration is that they're talking about a domestic terrorism statutes and being able to call something like this domestic terrorism. And everybody that I've talked to agrees that this is an exemplar of domestic terrorism. As far as the attacker himself, you'll note that I avoid saying his name. I call him the attacker. I call him the shooter. I call him things like that. There's things like that that you can do. But I mean, I also don't expect the media to not report on these things, because something like this that affects the African-American community so heavily, you have to be able to report on it. There is another issue that I think it has some validity, and it's kind of new, is that a lot of people have referred to his quote manifesto, and we don't like using the word manifesto, because a manifesto suggests that there's something worthwhile learning about what's in those pages. And I've seen those pages, and I know what his ideology is, and I know how he justified it. And from what I've seen in the manifesto, you can draw out what his reasoning is, but the way he justified it and the way that he supported his arguments were gibberish. It was copy and paste jobs from other types of writing. It was memes. It was nothing.
It was a screed. It was
more or less
random postings.
More or less random postings, things he copied from the internet, things he cut. He just full lifted from other shooters' writing, along with things, lists of the kinds of weapons that he had, lists of kinds of weapons that he wanted, things like that. It's not a political document, other than the fact that he talked about why he performed the shooting.
Right, right. So how do you suggest we talk about this person?
Yeah, I mean, I think referring to him as a terrorist is the best way to do it, because that's exactly what he did. He's inflicting terror. But I also want to just add to this too, right? It's not just his act, but it's also been the response to the act that actually, you know, continues some level of terrorism, right? And when racialized terrorism, as we talk about in this country. For example, we have not seen Blue Lives Matter folk out there for Officer Sadler that was killed. And here is a retired police officer, a distinguished police officer out of the Buffalo Police Department, who was working part-time in his retirement as a security guard. We haven't heard them do anything yet. We haven't heard the NRA say anything about this officer that was protecting the people to the best of his ability in that. We have not heard conversations about how white mothers need to raise their sons so they don't grow up to be terrorists. But yet when we see black crime and when we see quote-unquote black-on-black crime, we want to talk about how mothers are not showing up, how dads aren't present in a home. There has not been this same level of outrage that has often been very dog whistle language against the African American community about what's happened with this young man. We did not see that in the case with Dylann Roof. We did not see it in the case with the young man that killed folk up in Wisconsin. And so we need to talk about both the terror that occurs before, during, and then the response afterwards that doesn't hold the white community accountable for white Christian nationalism and white supremacy and how it's manifesting itself in young people.
I'd be curious about your response to that, Kurt.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that a lot of individuals, not all of them, but a lot of the individuals that claim to be part of some of these movements, they're hypocritical in when they pick and choose where they go. One of the things that a lot of terrorism researchers have picked up on are a lot of the groups that were on Capitol Hill on January 6th. A lot of them claim Blue Lives Matter, but they had no problem beating police officers Absolutely. With American flags and other kinds of weaponry. And again, that's not to say all of them, because there are some people who are honest supporters of police, honest supporters of first responders, but a lot of these groups and a lot of these individuals, they co-opt these phrases. And the only reason that the phrase Blue Lives Matter came out was because it was a way to co-opt Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely.
Let me quote or comment on something that the FBI director said. Now, this was about a year ago. He was responding to what happened at the U.S. Capitol. But he said, as far as the FBI is concerned, that racially motivated domestic extremists such as white supremacists, the top threat facing Americans today. You're nodding your head, Kurt.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's been that way for some time. The data show that really since up until the election of Barack Obama in 2008, white supremacy and militias in the U.S. were relatively stable. They were there. They've always been there, relatively stable. You saw a huge spike in 2008, 2009 in response to the election of Barack Obama. Then you see it even out again. And then after the election of Donald Trump, you see it spike again. Huge spike. So a lot of extremism researchers have been trying to scream from the rooftops for years that this is coming down the pipeline. We need to be ready for it. And sure enough, we've seen it manifest in the last year or two.
And we're almost up on a break here, but clearly we're not ready for it.
Oh, no, not at all. We're starting. It's a very slow turning ship. We're paying attention to it now, but clearly we haven't become ready for it.
I know you want to say something. We have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about what happened in Buffalo, New York, at a supermarket on Saturday. A white supremacist, self-described white supremacist, killed 10 black people who were shopping at a grocery store. 3 people have been wounded. We're talking about what happened, what it says about race relations, what it says about white supremacy, conspiracy groups, nationalist ideology. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne, and we're talking about the rise in violent extremism and racial hatred after a white supremacist killed 10 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. 3 people were wounded. And again, our guests are Bishop Dwayne Royster. He is Executive Director of Power, and that's the largest faith-based social justice organization here in Pennsylvania. Kurt Braddock, Assistant Professor in the School of Communication, also faculty fellow at the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, and that's at American University. Bishop Royster, you wanted to say something. Had to jump on that break, but no,
sure.
Go ahead.
Sure. We were talking about white white extremism, white supremacy, white Christian nationalism, as I refer to it, becoming mainstream. And I mean, you know, we talk about it increasing and being a threat here in the U.S. I mean, that became evident Tuesday in Pennsylvania. Doug Mastriano.
This is the Pennsylvania primary.
This is the gubernatorial primary. Doug Mastriano, landslide victory and the Republican nomination for governor of the state of Pennsylvania. Doug Mastriano is a white Christian nationalist. Very clear, 3 weeks before the election, had a rally, talked about the fact that Jesus was going to cleanse Pennsylvania and reclaim it for, you know, for God. You know, was with some QAnon folk and others that were present that day, got over, I believe, 50% of the vote in the Republican primary. I mean, white Christian nationalism, white supremacy is manifesting itself here in the state of Pennsylvania as Doug Mastriano, the white Christian nationalist, is now running against the Jewish attorney general, Josh Shapiro, who has a black lieutenant governor candidate that's running with him. The conversation I was having with folk on Tuesday night clearly indicated that we are in a very difficult situation here, and this race is probably going to be deeply anti-Semitic, deeply anti-black. It's going to be racist as the ads. I mean, even some of the ads that were being run by some of the super PACs that were out there during the election, during the primary cycle, had deep racist dog whistles that were involved in them, going after Kathy Barnett, who was a Republican that was running, African-American woman. We are in a real danger zone here, and we have to be able to find different ways to show up for each other in Pennsylvania.
Kurt, you've been looking at dog whistles. You have, there's a kind of a unpronounceable name for it, or stochastic terrorism.
Yeah, stochastic
but
you, terrorism.
You describe it as a form of incitement. This is a tweet that you tweeted out just a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. where the speaker uses coded language, dog whistles, and other subtext to justify, promote, or advocate the use of violence without providing overt directives to do so.
Right.
And then you go on from there.
Yeah. So this is a form of incitement that I've been looking at more recently. And I've noticed that, especially since the election of Donald Trump in 2016, that it's become a more prominent form of political communication from the right, in that they've found that as long as they don't directly incite violence, they don't direct violence, and it doesn't – the laws for incitement in the U.S. are essentially you have to direct violence, and that violence needs to happen right after. They found that they can use this kind of coded language, racist language, anti-Semitic language, language that kind of – through subtext justifies or normalizes the use of violence against their enemies, they found that people are drawn to that.
Well, give us an example.
January 6th.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's the prime example is that although Donald Trump was acquitted in the Senate for what happened on January 6th, there are countless studies that show that people who hear that kind of language would be motivated by it. And he's not legally bound to what happened on January 6th, we know from years of social scientific research that people on Capitol Hill that day, they were incited by his words. He said things like, you have to show strength. We're going to go up to Capitol Hill. Maybe we don't need to be so nice anymore. We shouldn't fight so nice anymore. I believe it was Giuliani who said we need to have a trial by combat. I'm not sure if it was him or not, but somebody said something along those lines. And although nobody directly said we need to storm the Capitol, that's the way that they took it.
Well, which to you, Bishop Royster, so what we're dealing with isn't hooded white supremacists on horseback terrorizing black people. I mean, this is a much more subtle, but it sounds like the way Kurt's talking about it, you know, lethal form of racism.
Well, I'm not sure it's subtle. I think it's very blatant in many regards. I mean, I think we hear it in the halls of Congress every single day. I think we hear it in the halls of our state capitol because there are many folk of similar mindset that are sitting in Harrisburg that think the very same way, that have absolutely no problem, articulating how they feel one way or the other. I mean, they're using coded language, but yeah, you're right. They're not using sheets anymore. They're wearing suits and dresses. And using very vitriolic language to call out blacks, call out immigrants, call out Muslims, call out Jews, call out anybody that they don't want. Poor folk, even though a lot of times poor folk are their base, they actually have issues with people who are impoverished as well, whether they're white, black, or any other race for that matter. And so we're in this deep moment. I mean, I remember going back to Charlottesville when they kept shouting again, one, you will not replace us. And the other thing that they said was that the South would rise again. And I think that we are in this moment where people feel dreadfully emboldened mm-hmm. to go ahead and say whatever's on their mind and speak and not worry about offending anybody, not worried about whether it's right or wrong. And we have some real challenges with that. We have some real challenges.
Well, even picking up on Charlottesville, and we were listening, you know, to some of the chanting yesterday in preparation for today's show, and it seemed to morph between "you will not replace us" mm-hmm. and "Jews will not replace us." Mm-hmm. I mean, they seem to be almost interchangeable, but that does get to this great replacement theory. I don't want to overstate what it is, but I'm looking at you, Kurt, and this seems to be a subtext of what's going on.
Yeah, the great replacement theory, if I can kind of explain it in a minute or so, is the idea that white America, and before it, white Europe, was being replaced by immigrants, non-white individuals, any people of color. And the anti-Semitism comes into it because a lot of individuals who adhere to this theory, they believe that the elite, which is another dog whistle for Jewish people, are orchestrating this great replacement to change the demographics of the United States in an artificial way to benefit immigrants and other people of color. There's no basis to this great replacement theory, but the fact that these kinds of ideas are normalized every day on cable news networks, specifically, I mean, I've called him out 100 times already, Tucker Carlson show, it's clear he's not even using a dog whistle anymore, it's a bullhorn. The fact that it's so normalized on these kinds of shows, what we see now is one-third of Republicans actually believe this theory, for which there's no evidence.
And there is some truth in that we are on our way to becoming a majority-minority country. I mean, I personally welcome that. But you know, so there's always that tiny little kernel of truth.
Yeah, actually, in 2017, I did the Tucker Carlson show shortly after Donald Trump released his first budget. And I refer to his first budget as an act of ethnic cleansing, to which Tucker Carlson wanted to take me to task on that on his show. And I simply said, look at the budget and see where the resources are going, see who's benefiting from it, and then who are we trying to hurt, especially with this deep anti-immigrant campaign that was going on at that time. We are in a situation right now where even some of those policies that Trump put in place are still in place in the Biden administration. Some of them are now beginning to change, especially as it relates to immigrants and other communities. But when you go back and look at the budget, which is a moral document, our state budget, our federal budget, and we look about who benefits from those resources, it's not folk that are, that it's not people of color. It's not women. There's a very limited segment of white men who are profiting, making the most out of this. And so when we talk about the great replacement theory, it's sort of like, who's benefiting, right? Who are we replacing? We're not sitting atop the Fortune 500 companies, right? We're not the ones that are, basically the puppet masters that are running the government of this country, the oligarchs that are out there. I know we talk about them in the context of Russia, but I mean, we have oligarchs in this country as well. I mean, we're watching Elon Musk right now with this whole battle with Twitter, right? These are oligarchs, right, that are trying to control, manipulate, and they're all white men. So, like, let's call it for what it is, let's really address it. I mean, we're right down the street here in the studio from Independence Mall, where the Constitution and Declaration of Independence were written. But let's remember, when those Constitution and Declaration of Independence were written, the only people that had real power in this country and real access to the vote and to be able to do anything else were landowner white men, and that was it. I think they're still trying to live into that concept. When we think about Supreme Court justices that are originalist and want to go back to the original interpretation of the Declaration and Constitution, they're going back to a time when white men are the only ones that have power. Not even white women, white men were the only ones that had power. And I think we have to recognize that this continues in this country in a very bad way, to continue to create oppression, disinheritedness, and dispossession of people who are legitimately here to try to get a better life.
Let me pick up on something, and this is Senator Ron Johnson. I'm looking at you, Kurt. In terms of understanding this the sort of embedded language.
Mm-hmm.
He claims the Biden administration, quote, wants complete open borders. And you have to ask yourself, why is it really they want to remake the demographics of America to ensure there that they stay in power forever? Is that is what is happening here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have a list here of sort of similar comments coming, frankly, from members of the Republican Party.
Right.
Is that what we're dealing with?
That's what we're dealing with, yeah, that sort of idea. That is the kind of coded language that I study that kind of gets at this great replacement theory. And I hate calling it a theory, too, because a theory suggests that there might be evidence for it. But, yeah, that's the kind of language that we're talking about when we talk about this great replacement phenomena or idea that people have, and that's kind of how they do it. They raise an idea, and then it's always followed up with a question, as if to ask, "Well, I'm just asking questions. Maybe you should think about this." And that's somebody like Tucker Carlson's formula: is to say something and then ask the audience, "Well, I'm just asking. I never said this. I never said do A, B, or C. I'm just kind of asking questions about it." And that's how they raise the ideas.
And Liz Cheney tweeted this week: "The House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse. At GOP, leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them." Agree, Bishop?
Yeah. First of all, for Liz Cheney to say that, considering who her father was, that's pretty amazing. But I think, you know, for lack of a better term, she had a come to Jesus moment with her own party. In terms of how they treated her when she was standing on the side of right and saying, no, we've got to hold Trump accountable. This should not have happened. And for them to ostracize her, run people against her, try to not. I mean, I think we're in this moment where some people are, and I don't want to say, I want to say they're being awakened because then people are getting to this notion of wokeness. But I think Liz Cheney's like seeing it and she's saying, wow, this is really problematic and we have to do something about it. And I would, you know, I don't agree with a lot of things with Liz Cheney, but in this particular circumstance, I do agree with her.
Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Todd. I occasionally listen to what I call hate radio. And this week, Sean Hannity spent 8 minutes talking about the lunatic shooter who 5 years ago shot at Representative Steve Scalise before he got to the Buffalo shooting that just happened. They primed their audience. It's not 100% a partisan issue, Kurt.
Oh, no. I mean, right. Somebody adopting or co-opting politics as a justification for engaging in violence, it's not unique to one party or the other. But I follow data in how I draw my conclusions about what's going on. And every database, every study, every report from every intelligence agency is very clear. The bigger threat is the far right. I know that the far right often tries to paint the far left as a threat more than the right is, but the data just don't bear that out whatsoever.
Here's a tweet from a listener. The NRA says nothing about the murder of the store security guard, which both of you mentioned, because it proves a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun is nonsense. And I was reading, Bishop, about the fact that, and this was really just a headline about guns, that the production and purchase of guns has exploded something like several hundred percent in the last 20 years or so.
Yeah. And I mean, it got exceptionally bad during the COVID crisis. People were panicked. They were afraid that people were going to, you know, again, raid supermarkets. They were not going to have resources they needed to get to. And so the gun crisis went through the roof during the first 18 months of COVID. And you know, gun manufacturers ramped up their manufacturing and are selling. And unfortunately, we're still in this moment right now where as these incidents continue to occur, people on both sides of the aisle are now beginning to ask the question, do we need to arm ourselves?
Yeah.
And I think that's a real tragedy. That's a real tragedy.
Well, in certain ways, we're talking about an 18-year-old with an assault rifle, a Bushmaster.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
He apparently modified it illegally to be able to use high-capacity magazines.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, it's not hard to get their hands on these kinds of weapons. I mean, I try to stay out of the gun debate just because that's not my area, but I'm a pretty staunch constitutionalist. That said, I believe in somebody's right to bear arms, but I have no idea why somebody needs to bear that kind of arm, why a civilian needs a rifle that they can change in a way that makes them more deadly. These are weapons of war, and I understand that people, they want to hunt, they want to be able to protect themselves, but they can do those things without these kinds of weapons.
Well, and you mentioned the pandemic, and I mean, we've seen here in Philadelphia the rise of violent crime, of the murder rate going just through the roof, frankly, in the last couple of years. I don't know if it's totally about the pandemic or the fact that our institutions were, you know, essentially semi-functional during those terrible years.
I mean, I think I think the rise in gun violence in Philadelphia is a very separate issue from this. This was a young white man who said he was bored. He had nothing better to do going on the internet. I think what we're seeing happening here in Philadelphia is actually a result of disinvestment for the last 100 years in communities of color. And I talk about this actually quite frequently in some of the speeches that I give, that when we really look, Cornel West wrote a book, Prophesied Deliverance, some years ago that talked about actually Philadelphia. And he talked about this pervasive sense of nihilism that existed in the city, that there's a sense of deep hopelessness. And I think in the COVID crisis, one, we saw that black and brown folk were not getting access to testing and then having difficulty getting access to vaccinations. And then when we saw the numbers that show disproportionately black and brown folk were dying at a higher rate than white folk were and not getting necessarily the same level of care that they were getting, I think that hits people at a core. And so when at some point you begin to internalize that somebody does not value your life, you're not worthy, it does a job on you in terms of mental and emotional status. And so I think that that's part of what's happening. Now, I think in the case of this particular terrorist, I saw an article some years ago in Huffington Post that was written by a clergy person who said that for white people, equality feels like a demotion. And I think that we're dealing with young white men in this moment who have grown up with this notion of privilege in the world that are now recognizing we're coming to a day when we want to get to a level of equality and equity. And for them, if everybody else is privileged, then they are no longer special. They're no longer the honored ones, the exalted ones. And we have to recognize we've made an idolatry of white men, right? And that, you know, we've made idols of white men. And so as a result of that, now that, you know, black folk can be equal to them, black women, black men, you know, who it's sort of like, well, wait a minute, I'm not special anymore. Who am I, right? Because whiteness is not a concept that we actually understand the way that people understand blackness or being a part of a Latinx community or Asian Pacific Islander. And so they're lost. And and I'm not being an apologist for them by any means. I mean, that's their problem, right? You've had hundreds of years of privilege and supremacy, and y'all should have figured this out by now. That's on them to figure that out. But the way that they're acting out with this is that they're going to go back and try to oppress people so they can feel better about themselves.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break, and then, Kurt, I'll go to you. But in the meantime, I want to just make sure everyone knows what we're talking about, a whole host of things, the rise in violent extremism, racial hatred, what to do about it. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Bishop Dwayne Royster. He's Executive Director of POWER, the largest faith-based social justice organization here in Philadelphia. Kurt Braddock, Assistant Professor in the School of Communication at American University. His research focuses on the persuasive strategies used by violent extremist groups to recruit and radicalize. And I do want to get to our comments, but I want to turn back to you, Kurt, and talk about some of the research that you've done.
Sure.
About how people can get radicalized by going online or spending, you know, endless hours or days or weeks or months online. What is that process? What is the power of persuasion that can take someone to a really dark place?
Yeah, well, it's important to distinguish being online versus the kind of content they encounter online, because you don't become radicalized if you're, you know, playing Minecraft online for hours and hours. I know that the shooter talked about being bored and going online. And that's where he got radicalized. But it's more about the content that they encounter and then the ideology it espouses that what drives them in that direction. Oftentimes what we see with young people like this shooter is that they get into these communities online, and more we're seeing that they kind of have these kind of meme inside jokes that dictate what's going on in the world around them. More and more, rather than being exposed to just standard what we think of as terrorist propaganda, although that does still exist, more and more we're seeing kind of these little winks and nods, these racist memes, and that's how they pick up on these ideologies. And beyond that, that's when they start looking into the deeper ideas that underpin these memes.
And do we know why some people are attracted to this and other people are not?
Well, there is no it's a common refrain to say there is no terrorist profile. There's no way to identify somebody that might go down that path aside from the kinds of behaviors they engage in and the sorts of upbringing they have. Now, we have identified something that we call root causes of terrorism, but this is a bit of an older perspective where people used to explain away extremism and terrorism by saying, well, it's poor people or it's uneducated people. Those are structural conditions out of which somebody might seek out opportunities to engage in something, but by themselves they don't explain anything. Typically, it's people who they choose to engage with certain content, whether it be online or offline. They make these social links with people who are already involved, have conversations with those types of people, and then when they do this kind of process online, they often look for a way to connect the offline world with that. So with this shooter, it looks like he did spend a lot of time online. I don't attribute what he did to the time he spent online. I attribute it to the kinds of content he was engaging with.
Hmm. Here's an email from Oscar. I'll put this to you, Bishop. As someone who is black and from Buffalo and who has shopped at the same Tops grocery the week prior to the massacre, my thinking is as long as white people remain the majority in the U.S., nothing will change. The race is a social construct with no genetic basis at all. It has been the basis of the founding of this country. Bluntly, I have no hope for the future of this country. That's coming from Oscar.
Yeah, Oscar, thank you for that. And certainly our condolences to you and all the Buffalo community, as we said earlier. And in a moment, I actually want to read the names of those that were killed in Buffalo as well. We certainly want to honor them. But let me just, I understand your hopelessness, and I hear that. But I have to think that this is an apocalyptic moment for America. And I know a lot of people think Christian apocalypse, end of the world. Actually, apocalypse just means change. And this is a real change moment, both with COVID, both with the rise of white nationalism, white Christian nationalism in this moment, white supremacy. And it's an opportunity for us to reimagine the world that we want. We actually are working on a book called Architects of a New America, and about the ways that we can begin to lean into each other and find ways to cross race, cross faith, cross socioeconomic levels, and begin to see each other in a different way, and that see the gift and the value that we are together. You know, one of the big statements that we often like to talk about in America to say we weren't racist was that we were colorblind. And I have a tendency to say to people, no, I see color everywhere, and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Every community, every culture, every race, every faith, every tradition brings something beautiful to the human landscape. And when we can begin to change from being colorblind, which says everything's gray, to being able to say, no, I see color and it's wonderful. That difference is wonderful. That I used to listen to the Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright, and he had a sermon that said the difference is not deficient. And oftentimes in this country, we have a tendency to think that if somebody's different than us, there's some deficiency. No, actually, folks that are different than us are bringing something to us. If we can see the gift that they are to us and that we are to them, we can find a way to be in the world together.
Well, Kurt,
I just want to respond to that comment as well. And this is going to be very non-academic considering what I am. But a gentleman's name was Oscar that sent him an email.
Yes, Oscar.
I wanted to kind of talk directly to Oscar right now and let him know that if he's the type of person who likes to push back against those who push toward him, know that hopelessness is what this shooter is hoping for. He wants you to be hopeless. So if you are stubborn like I am, or you like to push back against those that try to push you, don't let that light die. That poem says, rage against the dying of the light. That's what he wants. He wants you to be hopeless. He wants you to be controlled, and he wants you scared. I know it's very difficult to see the light in all of this, but if you are, like I said, if you're stubborn like I am, maintain that light.
Well, let me also ask you, though, Kurt, if people can be sucked into this ideology in this world, mm-hmm. Can we suck them out?
We can. We have countless examples of where people have gotten involved in these movements and they've left these movements. We also have more and more research showing that we can help people build resilience to these ideologies, to protect themselves from them before they encounter them. One of our biggest tools that we have in our toolkit to help people get out of these movements are people who were involved and then left themselves. I know several former right-wing extremists who it's a very common refrain that when they got involved, it was nothing like they thought it was going to be. They had all these delusions of grandeur. It was going to be fantastic. They were going to wage holy war, and they get in, and it's nothing like they thought. They have stories to tell people who are already involved and want to get out. In terms of protect, I think the better thing that we can do, though, in terms of kind of turning off the faucet, is this research that I've been doing refers to something called attitudinal inoculation. And this is something that's been around for 60 years now in the realms of health communication, more standard political communication. It's the idea that if you let somebody know before they're exposed to an idea that there is some third actor out there that's going to try to exploit them, to use them through messages, to get them to do something on their behalf, and then you give them counterarguments against what they're going to encounter, people are pretty resilient. We have this unique tendency, especially in the United States, sure. I keep saying stubbornness, to start develop what I call psychological antibodies against those sorts of things. And we've conducted several studies now that show that if we give people these messages, when they're exposed to disinformation, when they're exposed to far-right propaganda, a couple cool things happen. Number one, they get angry at the source of the propaganda. Number two, they counter-argue against it. Number three, they think the source isn't credible at all. Number four, they say they have no intention to support the source of the propaganda, including with armed support.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. And I also want to say to Oscar, check out voicebuffalo.org. That's our movement up there of people of faith, multiracial, multi-faith movement of people that are trying to do the exact opposite of what this terrorist did. And so please get to there as well. But I actually agree with you. I think that, Dr. John Powell of the Haas Institute for Inclusive Society out of UC Berkeley, talks about and actually talked right after Trump was elected about this is either a bridging or breaking moment, right? And so we have to have those bridges, right? Those folk that have gotten in and then gotten out, that are able to help other people be able to bridge to a different way of being and a different way of showing up. We often sometimes talk about them, credible messengers that are actually able to, we talk about that from the gun violence perspective, in the streets, but it also works the same way for people who have been, indoctrinated in this white supremacist or white Christian nationalist ideology, for those that have gotten out to be a credible messenger to go back to them and to pull them out. But then I also want to push and say, then it's also not just good enough to get out, but now you got to put yourself in a situation like it is when you're trying to deal with implicit bias, right? You've got to put yourself in a situation when you're dealing with the other, have experience of others so that you can actually see them differently than the way that you've imagined them prior.
Here's a comment from Jim. I just read an article about how white evangelical churches are promoting conspiracy theories. They're growing in members while those who stick to traditional messaging are striking out. Hate speech is finding a home in the safety and security of some white evangelical churches. Do you see that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when we talk about white Christian nationalism, I mean, it's taken its root out of the evangelical church in America right now. And again, we talk about, for white evangelicals in many ways, and I'm a recovering evangelical, so I will say that. I had an undergraduate degree from Evangelical University. It was ordained in evangelical denomination originally. And so I have deep inroads into this space. But there is this deep ideology, like it's either the way that we do it or there's something wrong with you. And the image that we worship is a white old man with white hair sitting on a throne, and you can't change that image any way, shape, or form. And so evangelicalism in this country, for the most part, is deeply rooted in this notion of white male idolatry. And it is deeply rooted in this notion that there is this conspiracy. The devil's around every corner that's trying to take your power. They're trying to take you away from being the person that you are, the God-given power that God has given you.
Well, interesting. And we were talking about this before going on the air, Kurt, which is when you look at the sort of more extreme versions of almost any faith, how much they have in common.
Yeah. This is definitely a question for other guests than me. But I mean, if you look at the major Abrahamic religions, they're all pretty similar. If you look at some of the justifications that a lot of extremists use, they're all pretty similar. Their gods have different names. Sometimes their prophets have different names, but they're often very, very closely tied. I know there is a sect of Christian extremists who seek to engage in violence to help bring about essentially the apocalypse, the end of the world. That is literally why ISIS was engaging in violence in the Middle East, to bring about this caliphate, which could only be brought about through the end of the world. So when you hear what we've heard called white Christian nationalism, when we hear about this white America, it's no different than when ISIS was trying to build this caliphate in the Middle East. It's almost the same exact thing.
You were talking about saying the names of the victims.
Yeah.
I have a list here. I know you have a list, and my producer just posted. But why don't you do it, Bishop?
Sure. Aaron Sadler, Ruth Whitfield, Catherine Kate Massey, Pearlie Young, Hayward Patterson, Celestine Cheney, Roberta Drury, Margus Morrison, Andre McNeil, Geraldine Talley. And we also lift up the three of those folk that were injured that day, Zaire Goodman, Jennifer Warrington, and Christopher Braddon.
I mean, hearing you say those names just brings tears, hopefully, to everybody's eyes. These are people who were died or seriously wounded, went through a horrific nightmare on Saturday. And I'm looking also, I mean, age 67, age 72, age 77, age 86, and some younger people as well.
That's
these
right.
were people who had lived essentially a long life.
Mm. Some of them lived lives long enough that they remember Jim Crow.
Yeah.
That they've had to live through James Crow Esquire, and then to have their lives taken for the very thing that many of them, one of them was a civil rights worker, had been fighting all her life, to be taken by a white supremacist in a supermarket, in that sacred space where people were trying to show their love through food, is absolutely tragic. It is an American tragedy that has occurred. It's not just a black tragedy. It's an American tragedy. And if we don't learn from it, then we are destined to keep repeating it over and over again.
I mean, what are the lessons? I'm looking at the clock here. What are the lessons we should learn?
Lessons, all life's valuable. Black lives are valuable, important. That we have to learn that all of us are equal, and that it's not a demotion for white folk just to be equal with black folk, and that there's nobody replacing anybody. All of us have a right to be here, to live and to thrive, but we have to find ways to do it together.
Is that, I mean, how do you see it? What are the lessons, if there are any, of what happened?
I mean,
and it's going to happen again.
It will happen again. It'll happen several more times.
Right.
The lesson here, I think, academically, which is why I think I'm here, is that we need some form of media literacy and race literacy among children at the younger ages, so they recognize what they're getting, what they're seeing online, what's true, what's false, what's not. But on a more kind of personal level, I think I really like the reference of apocalypse to change, because I do think this is a huge inflection point in the United States right now. And I just this year read James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time.
Mm.
And that's, I'm reminded of the way he closed The Fire Next Time. He said, if we don't take care of these problems, then, I mean, we're going to be facing something that nobody had ever imagined could happen in the United States. So I think it's incumbent on all of us to be able to deal with these issues. It's very, very difficult to think about how we go about doing that, but we do have the means to do it. We just need to have the will to implement it.
And we're almost out of time. Bishop, are we up to the task?
I think we have no choice. And I think that this is the moment now for people to stop sitting in their chair, stop watching television, stop, you know, just listening to radio, but to get up and do something, right, in partnership with what we're learning from those spaces, to be able to grow and create transformation in the world. I don't know anybody that wants to live in a world full of evil. I think we all want to live in peace. So let's find the way to do that, where we can see and respect and understand the dignity of all human life, all of creation, and be able to honor each other in the process.
Well,
I want to say, because there's such good advice being given out to listeners, if there are listeners out there who might be hearing this, who might feel themselves going down this path, know that there are resources for you to keep you from going down that and doing something along the lines of what we saw in Buffalo. One of the benefits or one of the good things about the kind of counter messaging that I do research on is that it approaches people and says, listen, we know you're not violent. We know you're not an extremist. Mm-hmm. We want to help you keep from becoming that way because it benefits those people too. The people who are killed are the obvious victims of this, but individuals who go down these paths, I don't call them victims, but mm-hmm. they can be saved from doing that.
Well, it's been such an important conversation and, frankly, a pleasure talking to both of you. Thank you for coming in and joining us today on Radio Times. Kirk Braddock and Bishop Dwayne Royster, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Go to WHYY.org, and you can look for Radio Times under programs, whether this program or others. We've got thousands of them there, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.